The story begins in the sixth month. The angel Gabriel was sent by God to a town in Galilee called Nazareth, to a virgin engaged to a man whose name was Joseph of the house of David. The virgin's name was Mary. And the angel came to her and said, "Greetings, favored one. The Lord is with you."
What does that mean?
She was much perplexed by his words and pondered what sort of greeting this might be. And the angel said to her, "Be not afraid, Mary, for you have found favor with God. And now you will conceive in your womb and bear a son, and you will name him Jesus. He will be great, and he will be called the Son of the Most High, and the Lord God will give to him the throne of his ancestor David. He will reign over the house of Jacob forever, and of his kingdom there will be no end." To the angel Mary said, "How can this be, since I have known no man?" The angel said to her, "The Holy Spirit will come upon you, and the power of the Most High will overshadow you. And therefore the child to be born will be holy. He will be called Son of God. And now your relative Elizabeth, in her old age, has also conceived a son, and this is the sixth month for her who was said to be barren. For nothing will be impossible with God." And Mary said, "Behold, the servant of the Lord. Be it done unto me according to your word." And the angel departed from her. The word of the Lord. The actual words, few and simple, came to me during a conversation with my very close friend John near the end of my seminary training. Interpretation is everything. Now, a real insight does not drop in on our mind like a sudden seed, and then the truth grows up from it. No, it's almost the reverse, really. Real insight comes more like the final stage of work on a satisfying painting. For a long time, you're working in the medium of a new understanding, but you can't see the whole. So when at last the new idea of insight comes home to rest in your mind in so many words, it's not that the words themselves are carrying the truth like a pail carries water. Rather, you would say, had you heard the words sooner in your life, they would not have carried you up on eagle's wings the way these words were doing for me. Insight, this was. Interpretation is everything. Those words are more like the coin minted by long preparation, neither more nor less than coins. This is how I came to that matter, to say that interpretation is everything. And after you see it that way, you really can't go home again. Now you are responsible for what you think, what you feel, what you do. You don't anymore believe that you can stand before authorities and have the truth sink into you the way sun sinks into a sunbather. No, there is a filter on everything that you think and feel and do. Tag, you're it, the filter, whether you like it or not. The truth is not out there. It's something you have to take responsibility for. No more do you say, "She makes me feel guilty." It doesn't work. Rather, it comes out, "When I listen to her, really listen to her, I feel my guilty feelings, though I don't really want to." No more religion as child's nose pressed up against the baby Jesus stories, wishing you could get in the play and have belief come easy. No, when interpretation is everything, you are already in the scene. You see the lights and the camera. You see the moving star on a crane. You see the bin labeled extra hay. You see the evangelist bent to an encyclopedia article on gift-giving practices of astrologers in the ancient East. Interpretation is everything, and you are responsible for your interpretation, and you can't go home again. So I believed, and so I taught for a number of years. It seemed to me that all new knowledge was, as I used to say, the old bent, meaning that learning. Brain science more or less cooperates with this idea that learning is taking hold of something already grasped and bending it, altering it a little bit, and hence a sort of new based on something old. See, like this, all growth in understanding, like growth in plants, happens at the tip. But after a time, I felt, I didn't think, but I felt there was a hole in this understanding. I had come to the bottom of a sorrow. I was bereft of trust that my own will, my own wisdom, my own words would work me up out of my sorrow. Was it possible to learn something new in this place? I wondered, something absolutely new, something not grounded in what I'd previously known. How can this be? I asked. For I have known no other way as a man. And yet, even in the asking, is there a different way to learn? Is there the absolutely new? Does God work new? Even in the asking and answering was seeking its voice. Because I knew, I hoped the answer was yes, though I had no idea how it might come. I hoped that somehow I might receive a word from beyond the powers of thought. I hoped that thought might be servant to the master. And no longer master. And I saw that if this were possible, the new must come into an empty space. Into a space where no knowing of my own would grab it and haul it off to one of the caves of my personality and have its way with the new. Is there something in us which has no account of itself, which is not self-aware in that sense or protective, which has no story at all, neither pride nor skill nor fear nor hatred nor guilt nor even sin? Is there that, a place within wherein nothing is? Nothing to bend, nothing to grasp. If there is not, then I tell you, there is nothing new at all in human existence, just baubles. We would indeed have to say that we are tethered to that terrible ball of Sisyphus if there is no genuinely new work of God possible. But I saw that if true new may become manifest, I must first know nothing in some real practical sense. For the new would only come into an emptiness which knew it not and could not grasp it. An emptiness like the Virgin's, like Mary's. Now, to say, like the Virgin Mary, sounds like just another interpretation. A slight, if sudden, bending of the old story of Maiden Mary and her empty womb and her open self visited by the angel. Is it just that? I propose to you that Mary is much more than a metaphor. For my part, you know, I couldn't say whether the woman who bore Jesus of Nazareth said or did any of what we sing of her. I do know that the odds against it are very long. But what I would say next is beyond doubt. The story of Mary's God-visited, open, empty, virgin soul has been handed down to you and to me by masters of the soul, people who care for the soul. Here in Mary is the opening to a pathway that you cannot find in yourself with thought. There is no self-help book on the shelves that dares say what Mary invites you and me to do and to be. Mary stands for hope that God's true new may come upon you. Yes, you, O favored one. What can that mean? That which you need but cannot even name. It is so far beyond your understanding when you encounter this possibility. It is that without whose hope, on the other hand, you are left circling in your pen of pleasures or pains, but nevertheless your pen and no bigger than yourself. Mary shows how this hope comes. It is not by interpretation, but through an emptiness in which we have left untouched some part of ourselves. We have offered it, prepared for God. Hope is a name for this. It is the other way we learn. Interpretation here, hope there. But now a caution about hope. Hope itself comes in two kinds. The first kind we should call ordinary hope. Ordinary hope hopes that something you have in your imagination, thought, will come to pass, that some power will bring it about because you don't have all that's needed. This kind of hope is rooted in memory. It's rooted in thought. It's not really new when you think about it. Ordinary hope. I hope you get well. I hope you get the job. I hope my health is restored. I hope I could have a reunion with my son. These things we either knew once and lost and want it back, so it's from memory, or we have seen it somewhere, and we've come to desire it. A Caribbean vacation, a certain kind of professional degree, peace on earth. It's wishing. Ordinary hope. Most prayers have the shape of ordinary hope, and they change nothing, for they strengthen the illusion that conditions out there have to change, not so much the condition in here of the interpreter, the receiver, the prayer. We wait for our ordinary hopes, very aware of time passing. Sometimes sure that the thing will come like a train, sometimes not, like the end of a drought, patiently, impatiently, depending on our personality. But ordinary hope always has the same trajectory, happy, sad, good, bad, up and down. The Buddhists call it samsara, the endless cycle of birth and death. Just uttering the hope that things should turn out my way carries within it an echo of fear that time and chance will shun my path and hope will fail and I, left hopeless, will be. That's ordinary hope. It's not what we're talking about this morning. There is another kind of hope. It comes not at the call of ordinary thought. You hear of it in Mary's emptiness, in her openness, her virgin nature. She trusts in God, though she knows not how God will act. She says, "How can this be?" But not by way of resistance. She is ready for the new to come in her emptiness. This is the other way we learn. She is learning. She is the exemplar of learning absolutely about the freshness of God's possibility. In a lovely book of this name, Cynthia Bourgeau calls this hope mystical hope. Mystical hope has no object, no particular desire. Its blessing is not out there in time. It arrives present now, in the middle of any burden whatsoever, in the middle of any success whatsoever. It is not attached to the low or the high. The apostle says, "I have learned how to be abased and how to abound." He has learned the treasure of mystical hope. Words cannot give compass to the joy, the satisfaction in this mystical hope. Does it sound like the attitude of some simple-minded faith? Perhaps to some. Perhaps to a cosmopolitan, it sounds like a kind of innocent faithfulness that you would not be caught dead in. And you won't be caught dead in it if you have not yet understood mystical hope. The spirit of emptiness can land in you like a dove, but you must want it. If you hear this word today, Mary's word, the Mary's way, here to show that there is more than you have met in your sorrow or in your pleasure. If you hear this word today, then the preparation for hope absolute has begun as a kind of learning. Everything else we do in this life is just struggle compared. I'm sure that some in this room right now are hungering for a word like this. If you are one, hungering for a way forward, where things seem blocked absolutely by your fear of the future. If you find that your thoughts are strung out across the day, wishing this ordeal were done, hoping that that sweet will may come. If you're ever there and never here, may this word land in you like a dove. It is our human condition so often to be like this. It is tragic that most Christians have been taught only to wish it away. That's what prayer is, wishing things away. The Christian tradition is filled with guides for finding paths where God will meet you and go down beneath the fearful struggles that our ego constantly puts up in its vision, its wrong vision of what is so. Mary is the pioneer. She is the first one. She bears the Christ. In a way, she bears you. Learn from her. Learn to empty yourself of what you think you know, that you may bear Christ alive. Here's one way it came to the poet Yeats. My 50th year had come and gone. I sat a solitary man in a crowded London shop, an open book, an empty cup on the marble tabletop. While on the shop and street I gazed, my body of a sudden blazed, and 20 minutes more or less it seemed so great my happiness that I was blessed and could bless. That is mystical hope. What is it to empty your cup, to open the book of your mind, to empty the womb? What is it? How do you empty the womb of your creative spirit, open your mind that God may freely move within you and bring Christ to bear? How? Practice is wanting, a discipline. This is not some chance thing God throws down at some because they're good. Practice is wanting to prepare the space. A commitment of your soul daily, perhaps several times daily. The practices of the contemplative arts, which we will endeavor to teach here for those who would learn. These are the narrow way. The way of Mary. The way that only a few take, but that you may take. For no one finds this way except at need. It is Advent. Learn to empty yourself and God will come. Meister Eckhart says, to be empty of creatures is to be full of God. Thomas Merton puts it more urgently. God is near to us at the point just before our final destruction. Take away everything else down to that point, and the last little bit before destruction is a little kernel of gold, which is the essence of you, and there is God protecting it. This is something terrific. The freedom that matters is to be in contact with that center. You have been blessed in a ministry that your sister Beth is sharing with you in pastoral letters from time to time, for she is walking exactly in this path and telling you about it. Friends, it doesn't get better than that. It is Advent. We are waiting. She is waiting. We are hoping. Not for Christmas Day, not for peace on earth, not even for just the right outcome. Our job is to learn mystical hope. Advent stands for this practice of emptying yourself of your attachments to those things you thought your happiness depended on. If you think you heard a sermon like this a few weeks ago, you did, because this is so central to the process of Christ coming alive inside you. May you be met in the matrix of hope where you accept God's seed delivered to you in your virgin womb, that you may conceive God absolutely new, Jesus Christ, the grace of God in you. No matter your condition, no matter what you suffer, may you ready your heart to say, "Behold, a servant of the Lord. Be it done to me according to your word."